NetSuite by Oracle brings accounting, finance, inventory, and HR into one proven platform, helping you reduce costs everywhere. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/wallstreet.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Foreign Edition. Now, Mary Kissel.
Turmoil in Tehran as the regime faces renewed protests over that country's flailing economy. And turmoil, too, in Washington as President Trump and his administration sends mixed signals about its Iran policy. Welcome to Foreign Edition. I'm Mary Kissel with the Wall Street Journal editorial board in New York City. My colleague Joe Sternberg is on book leave this month, so you're going to get not one but two episodes per week for this month with outside foreign policy experts. And I'm very pleased to welcome back to the program Benham Ben-Tulebu, a research fellow at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies, a think tank in Washington, D.C. Benham, welcome back to Foreign Edition.
Thanks for having me, Mary. Great to be back with you.
So let's start by taking listeners to the ground in Tehran. The local currency falling to its lowest level ever earlier this week. It's called the rial, hitting 119,000 to the dollar. It's almost halved in value since the beginning of the year, although it's since recovered in the last 24 to 48 hours. Economist Steve Hanke estimating inflation hit around 221%. That is painful. Benham, what does this mean for the average Iranian, and why is the currency dropping like a stone?
Well, this is a pretty bad picture for the average Iranian because the currency crisis is only the latest crisis of confidence that the government in Iran is facing. We know the regime is playing musical chairs with the head of the central bank. They appointed a new governor of the central bank, Mr. Hamati, whose resume reads like a record of who's who of designated entities. He's worked for basically every bank, every media station that's been designated by the U.S. Treasury Department.
When you say designated, you mean sanctioned.
Sanctioned, that's right.
So you've got them changing out the head of the central bank to instill confidence in the economy and monetary management, and they put in a guy who's been affiliated with sanctioned institutions. Okay, that clearly didn't work. What else
exactly
is going wrong in the economy?
Basically everything. There's longstanding structural issues in the banking sector. It's not a modernized banking sector, and this is compounding existing problems with how the government manages other issues. So if this is how it's managing its largest crisis of confidence, the economy, look at how it's managing the environment. Look at how it's managing the street protests. And the other day in the city of Isfahan, which is in Iran's center, there is this major river which has been drying up under the government in Iran because of its massive dam building and other poor policies affecting the environment, which has led to protests by Iranians. The river is called the Zayan Darud River, the life-giving river, but as many have pointed out, it's really become the river of death. It's dried out. This river has been in Iran for millennia. It's part of so much Persian history and Persian poetry. And really, under the past 20, 30 years of the Islamic Republic, even this river has been drying up. So both the musical chairs at the top with Iran's economy and the central bank governor and what is going on in Iran domestically on the environmental level are indicators of how poor the Islamic Republic is as a government, how poorly it manages Iran's national interests and how poorly it manages local affairs.
So
and then you take this picture.
You've got that, but you've also got the corruption from top to bottom, right? I mean, you have large swaths of this economy essentially controlled by a militia, the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, right?
That's right. And when you invite men with guns into the economy, into politics and society, it's very hard to uninvite them. And they've lodged in, you know, to the legitimate private sector, making that private sector feel the pain. You've seen the growth of this informal sector in Iran as people try to work for IRGC-owned or controlled entities. You've seen the growth of the state in Iran's economy. And you've seen corruption among men of the cloth, men who profess to be holy men. Khamenei himself, Iran's supreme leader, sits at the top of this foundation, which is basically his private holding company that has over, I think, $90 billion, if I recall correctly, in assets, many of which were confiscated both unjustly and illegally, according to Iranian law, let alone international standards. And this was all mentioned, I think, in a recent speech that I attended by Secretary Pompeo to the Iranian-American community at the Reagan Library. And I think that was an important turning point in how the administration at least will rhetorically call out these issues facing Iranians.
Well, I'm going to turn to that in a second, because layered on top of this pile of mess, which is the Iranian economy, you have the looming reimposition of U.S. sanctions that are going to start kicking back in on Monday. President Trump, of course, announcing in May that he was going to exit the Obama-era nuclear deal, and therefore the sanctions that were suspended by that deal will now come back into effect. The U.S. gave companies a 90-day window and I believe 120 or 160-day window to wind down their activities with Iran. So, you know, Ben, I'm looking at this list. Sanctions on U.S. dollar banknote purchases, gold and precious metals, aluminum, steel, coal, industrial software, the issuance of sovereign debt. Yeah, automotives. I mean, this is a long list. So I presume that this pain is only going to, you know, continue to get worse for the average Iranian.
Yes, and I mean, it's going to put the regime to a choice. And I think the Trump administration is gambling on the Iranian people noticing that at every juncture, the regime in Tehran continues to put ideology over national interest. And I think that will have long-term consequences for the future of the government in Iran and the future of the kind of the state structure in Iran. I would just say both that monetary policy crisis, both the environmental crisis, and then the long-standing division that we've seen in Iranian history between the state and society will be exacerbated, I think, by the sanctions. And it'll be up to the Iranian government to want to put their national interest first and come to the table and offset foreign pressure, reform their economy, or to double down.
Now, you and I have talked in the past about the protests that have erupted nationwide, the latest iteration starting in late December. It hasn't really died down, has it? Because it's extended to so many sectors of the economy. The traders in Tehran, there was a truck strike earlier this week. You have average citizens, you know, blue-collar workers getting out onto the streets. That continues, Benham. Is it getting enough media attention given the scope of these protests and the fact that they are nationwide? It's not just in the capital.
That's right. And they are not getting enough coverage, in my view. I think just because you don't have 3 million people wearing green in Tehran like you did in 2009 doesn't mean that the labor protests, the regular disputes that Iranians have, blue-collar Iranians have, the regime's social base has with their own employers and with the state doesn't deserve coverage. It absolutely does deserve coverage. And in fact, it deserves coverage because while you have so many different sectors of Iranian society, women protesting the hijab, farmers protesting the environment, truck and trade unionists protesting labor laws in Iran, Bazaaris protesting the currency crisis, average Iranians protesting the currency crisis, the regime's crackdown on all of these different groups. Their fundamental grievance, despite being social or economic, is framed politically. All these divergent groups are converging on chastising the regime for its foreign ventures and for failing to essentially put Iran first.
And then they're not blaming the United States. That, to me, is what's so remarkable here, is that the regime always used to fall back on, it's that evil devil in the White House in Washington. But that line isn't working anymore.
It's not working. And just the other day, it's pure mockery. The commander of Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, Major General Jafari, he called it the Black House, using this kind of loaded terminology of darkness and dampness, and saying that what's going on in the White House is actually corruption itself. So despite all this hyperbolic rhetoric, the Iranian people are not buying it. In fact, when you had Bazaaris just the other month protesting in Tehran, these are basically Iran's commercial class. They chanted slogans basically saying, our enemy is not in America, our enemy is here. You can't get clearer than that. And for those of us in Washington who have to deal with the argument that says, oh, rising Iranian nationalism means that everyone will rally around the flag, need to engage with the kind of slogans that average Iranians are levying against the regime.
We're talking about the economic turmoil inside Iran. We're going to turn to the Trump administration's policy toward the regime. You're listening to Foreign Edition. Stay with us.
This episode is brought to you by Vanta. Managing the requirements for modern security programs is increasingly challenging. Vanta's trust management platform helps you quickly assess risk, streamline security reviews, and automate compliance for SOC 2, ISO 27001, and more. Plus, save time by completing security questionnaires with Vanta AI. Learn how by watching Vanta's on-demand demo at vanta.com/WSJ. That's VANTA.com/WSJ.
The Future of Everything podcast from The Wall Street Journal. Another new episode is coming soon as we look at science, technology, and their influence on our lives. The Future of Everything podcast from The Wall Street Journal. The future is closer than you think.
From the opinion pages of The Wall Street Journal, this is Foreign Edition. Now, Mary Kissel.
Welcome back to Foreign Edition. Mary Kissel in Iranian gray New York City with Benham Ben Talebu, research fellow at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies in sunnier Washington. And we are talking about Iran, continuing the conversation here on Foreign Edition. Mixed signals a bit from the White House. President Trump saying on Monday during a press conference with Italy's Prime Minister Giuseppe Conte that he, Trump, would talk to the Iranian President Hassan Rouhani with, quote, no preconditions. And this generated a bit of consternation inside the Beltway. People asking, well, why would he sit down and talk to the leaders in Tehran when they're funding terror, when they are opposing us in Yemen, Iraq, Syria? So what's the thinking here?
I think that's a great question, because as far as I understand on Iran policy, there hasn't been a robust conversation both in Washington and as far as I can tell within the administration on would there even be preconditions in discussions with Tehran. Everyone has been pointing to, in the aftermath of President Trump's comments, that May 21st speech by Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, where he laid out 12 points. People have been saying those 12 points are the U.S. preconditions for talks. But actually, those 12 points read like end states or policy goals. So I don't know to date if this administration has genuine preconditions. I know Iran has been quick to respond to that, saying, no, we have two preconditions. You must treat us with respect and you must return to the JCPOA nuclear deal. It's absolutely preposterous, because I think this administration is doing everything to shun and shed the JCPOA mindset, I think, as some of their officials have been saying, and move towards a more comprehensive strategy of countering Tehran. And it is in the vein of that strategy that it does make sense to offer Iran an exit ramp. If your goal is to replicate maximum pressure on Iran, you need to have the people in Iran know that you have offered the revolutionary government in Tehran an exit ramp. And if the crisis escalates, it is squarely on them.
Well, look, I take Trump at his word. He says that talks are good. And in fact, when he made those comments about him, I thought it was interesting. He said, I'm not offering talks from a position of strength or weakness. I just think that talking is good. And I believe that's how he thinks. That's why he talked to Putin. That's why he talked to North Korea's Kim Jong-un. I don't think President Trump's willingness to talk necessarily signals a weakening of his policy toward those regimes. And indeed, the Treasury Department, which has levied these sanctions or is preparing to reimpose these sanctions on Iran, is plowing right ahead. And there's no indication there's no indication that policy is going to change. I don't like the idea of talking without preconditions, because I think that the fact of a U.S. president meeting with a group of thugs and killers like the Iranian regime lends them legitimacy on the world stage. I don't like that. Listeners can disagree with me. But Benham, to that point about Trump's strength, You wanted to talk about a tweet that the president issued late last month, an all-cap threat to Rouhani. This is what the president wrote. He wrote, "Never ever threaten the United States again, or you'll suffer consequences the likes of which few throughout history have ever suffered before. We're no longer a country that will stand for your demented words of violence and death. Be cautious." I think the president's offer to talk coming after that tweet was what confused people.
I mean, I think there's a lot going on here. I think genuinely with this administration, and I think given the president's instincts, but also correct instincts, I would say, on chastising the regime in Iran, praising the Iranian people, those are all correct instincts, and calling the JCPOA nuclear deal a bad deal. Given those instincts, anything that is possible. I think this president genuinely means it when he says everything is on the table. That could mean diplomatic reconciliation. That could mean conventional war. And reading the tweet into this broad array of options that literally exists on the table, I would say that I prefer, and I've kind of been forced to come up with this because I don't understand why we would want to not have the U.S. president use the bully pulpit to attempt to get changes in Iranian behavior. And it is in that vein that I have to say, I prefer caps lock to conventional war. If caps lock gets you results as opposed to conventional war, I would take that.
Well, of course, Benham. Yeah, I mean, yeah, of course. Yeah. Obviously, we're not advocating war with Iran on this podcast. I think what he's reestablishing leverage over Iran through U.S. sanctions. And I think he's making it clear to Rouhani, look, I'm a different guy. I'm not Obama.
That's right. And I think there are places where tough rhetoric has already gotten us results. I mean, we shouldn't be content with those results, but we should know where tough rhetoric has actually had an effect. And there's two domains I want to draw your attention to. The first is ballistic missile flight testing. We've had a sudden drop in ballistic missile flight testing under the Trump administration by Iran. There has been in Iran something I never thought I would see before. Usually when I read the Persian press, I expect hyperbole. For the first time in March 2017, I saw the Iranian press say that some of Iran's military commanders were afraid of what Trump would do, and hence they removed a satellite launch vehicle from a launch pad. We've only had 2 to 3 ballistic missile tests by Iran under the Trump administration. We've had 2 to 3 medium-range satellite launch vehicle tests by Iran under the Trump administration. The larger number is 23 ballistic missile tests since the JCPOA. That's an important metric to take away. We've had nine general ballistic missile tests by Iran under the Trump administration, 6 of them being in a theater of conflict. I think it's also important to note that you've had a sudden drop in harassment attempts in the Persian Gulf. The U.S. Navy reported 0 for 2018. And for 2017, compared to 2016, there was a sudden drop. There was only 13 or 14, whereas there was 35 in 2016, 23 in 2015.
But, Benham, you still have the regime in Tehran issuing threats against shipping in some of these key straits off of its coast. So you're right, they're not harassing naval vessels, but the rhetoric remains the same, doesn't it?
Rhetoric remains the same, and that's a problem. And that's why we should not be content with some of these achievements of our rhetoric on slightly impacting Iranian security policy. And we should also broaden the scope. You know, we may have Iran be more cognizant of our power in the Persian Gulf, but you have other rising powers or great powers like China who are more aggressive in the South China Sea. So we have to make sure that if we're going to levy rhetoric to get changes in adversarial and rogue state behavior, we're able to do this across the board. And you also don't want to be in a situation where Iran is less risk averse, is more risk averse in the Persian Gulf, but is more risk tolerant in the Red Sea and Bab el-Mandeb. You saw the Saudis actually have to redirect their tankers because they were afraid of the missiles that the Houthis in Yemen, which likely they received from Iran, were firing at tankers. So you don't want to see escalation in one theater, de-escalation in another. De-escalation
everywhere. That's right. Benham, is there any indication that the mullahs want to talk to Trump?
So far, no. I think the mullahs have been pretty adamant about looking to signal resolve against this president. I think they want to score political points. They want to underwrite Iranian deterrence. But I think this will change in 2019. We don't know if they'll make a private overture or whatnot. But the sanctions are slated to be levied in two phases, you mentioned, August and November. November has the heaviest. That has the oil sanctions, energy, shipping, insurance. That'll probably take a few months to take into effect. And then from there, the U.S. will have to enforce and keep plugging in loopholes that exist in current U.S. law on those sanctions. So I expect 2019 to be the year of decision both for American sanctions and American diplomacy. And that's why the president must adopt, come November, a zero prisoners approach. Take no prisoners. He must enforce the hell out of these sanctions. Otherwise, he'd be in the worst of both positions, because the Iranians remain adamant that they will not meet and that they will not alter their behavior.
Now, look, I'm looking for a more comprehensive policy to contain Iran and its regional ambitions. We don't have that yet. We were supposed to have it in January. Just last week, our colleagues at The Wall Street Journal on the news side reported that National Security Advisor John Bolton had convened a meeting of officials to discuss that comprehensive Iran policy, which I presume to mean pushing back on them in Syria, in Iraq, in Yemen, attacking their terror financing in Latin America, in Europe, and elsewhere, their control over the country of Lebanon and the missiles that Hezbollah, the Iran-backed militia in Lebanon, has pointed at Israel. I mean, it's a long list here, Benham, and given that they've had three separate national security advisors in there over a span of less than 2 years, I guess it's no wonder that you don't have a comprehensive policy yet, but boy, do they need one.
I mean, I think in terms of broad strokes of policy, there is an agreement that they want to push back against Iran in the region. But when it comes to taking that policy off the shelf and implementing it, I think in every theater they're running into a couple of different roadblocks. Syria is very unique because you have the Russian presence, you have the impetus of the president to want to de-escalate, withdraw American troops, you have the anti-ISIS mission being the priority for the U.S. military, and we don't really know what's going to follow after that. We don't want to create the same vacuum we created in Iraq in 2011. We don't really have American engagement and interest over what a future U.S. policy will be towards Iraq, whereas conversely, you have a lot of Iranian interest in looking to co-opt the institutions of the state in Iraq. And you have Iran ascendant in the region, proliferating missiles in Yemen, missiles in Syria, missiles to Lebanese Hezbollah, sending shoeless Afghan children to die on its behalf in the Syrian theater. And you're right, we lack a comprehensive response to this. There's been a desire to bring in the nuclear issue, the regional issue, and to put Iran's all of its threats into the same basket and deal with them comprehensively. It's just been proving to be pretty difficult so far. I'll take the limited victories we can get on limited flight testing numbers, as well as on the limited Persian Gulf harassment, but we cannot be content with this.
No.
This must be the beginning of a more comprehensive approach. This can't be something we take and set aside.
Couldn't agree more. And in the meantime, the financial pressure on the Iranian economy will continue. The protests continue. That's it for Foreign Edition today. I'm Mary Kissel in New York. On behalf of Benham Ben-Talebu in Washington, thanks for listening. We'll be back with you on Friday.
This message comes from Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort. Journey through the heart of Europe on an elegant Viking longship with thoughtful service, destination-focused dining, and cultural enrichment on board and on shore. And every Viking voyage is all-inclusive with no children and no casinos. Discover more at Viking.com.